Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Plodcast, presented by sportsshoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Plodcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. Big guest this week from over in the US, Stephen Haas, coach of Under Armour's pro team, Dark Sky Distance, and also a major track and field agent. Enjoy.
Thank you for tuning in once again. Track season is almost over. It feels like it's winding down. The Europeans are going to be almost wrapped up by the time you're listening to this one. But look, you can call this episode a double whammy if you like, considering Haas is an agent and a coach, and we talk pretty much all of that. We talk marketing in the sport, you know, where the actual money is with the shoe brands. Are we starting to see Europe almost, you know, look, with the developments of the On Running Group, are we starting to see similar, you know, groups take off? Not just in the UK, but in Europe. Will they aim to compete against America as well? And obviously, you know, he breaks down, you know, why American athletes are financially so much better off. And that is because, you know, shoe brands value the American market. It's where they put all their money. But he does say it's starting to level off a little bit as well. So it's good news for some of us over here. He talks American 1500 meter running, perhaps why it's not as strong as what it could be. Definitely not as strong as us in the UK either. He heads up the Dark Sky Distance project out in Flagstaff, sponsored by Under Armour, or backed by Under Armour as well. So he's coaching a lot of athletes. He's heavily involved with the likes of Neil Gawley as well. So good to tune in and listen to that one. Someone he was involved in. This is a big story that I was kind of super excited to and hear his take on. And thankfully, he went into quite a bit of detail on it. Was the Cheserek story. Obviously, we know how much of a phenom he was coming out of college. 17 times NCAA champion, virtually unheard of. And obviously he signed with, of course, Skechers. So he talks about that deal, and he talks about at what point in an athlete's career do you value finances over, you know, over performance, and are performances becoming less relevant when you talk about an athlete income. So, and to be honest, given our sport, I can't blame many athletes if they did choose finance, because I think there's a very rare opportunity that that's even a possibility, to be talking about the kind of money that could almost set you up for life. So he gives us a lot of interesting takes indeed. And he's actually out at the European Championships this week. He's in Munich and he was at the Commonwealth Games. So he gives us his take on that and compares it to, of course, Hayward Field, the World Championships, which he was also present at. So there's not many track meets this guy isn't present at. But look, enjoy the podcast. It's basically just a fountain of knowledge. So I hope you enjoy it. And take care as always. And we'll catch you next week.
Right. First of all, Haas, just welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for coming on, mate.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to talk to you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Look, we've wanted to get you on for a while. To be honest, obviously, you've been on the circuit in a number of capacities, like you coach, like you're an agent. And what do you sort of describe your job title as? Because I feel like you do a bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, pretty much exactly what you just said. I mean, I'm a coach, I'm an agent. Yeah, just try to be there for the athletes. I don't really care what you call me or what's the priority is in anybody else's heads. But yeah, do a little bit of both and think I've figured out a way to have a good balance with it.
Mm, for sure. Like, you're joining us from Germany, as we just discussed off there. How's the Europeans, mate? Like, how's it treating you? The atmosphere looks crazy from
stuff. Yeah, unbelievable meet. Yeah, one of the best meets I've ever been to. I got to be honest. I got to go to Europeans when it was in Berlin and thought it was really awesome meet then. And the Germans really, really show out for their home athletes. Last night was honestly one of the most electric environments I've ever seen at a track meet. When the girl won the 100 last night, when the decathlete won, I mean, the whole stadium was just absolutely rocking. So really, really cool. I hope it's close to the same atmosphere for the 1500 finals. I mean, I think that'd be just the coolest thing to race in a stadium that is so loud and so full of people. I mean, really, really cool, cool environment. It was awesome. Yeah.
Man, I agree. It came across on TV as well. Sometimes we're disappointing fans at track events, but You know, I think yesterday showed that it is still there, and it does, you know, people are interested in it, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was so disappointed with Worlds after being there last night. I'm like, oh my gosh, if we could get this side of this sort of atmosphere at a U.S. track meet, it would be so awesome. But yeah, it's really cool to see. I mean, I'm fortunate that I get to see meets like that every year. You know, Zurich for the Diamond League final, I feel like has a great atmosphere. Brussels has a great atmosphere. Some of these big meets that you're in stadiums that are full and you got a really, really knowledgeable crowd and everybody's into every single event. I mean, they were standing on their feet for the women's discus, you know, it was awesome. So, yeah, it's just I'm really fortunate I get to see meets like that and know that it does exist, you know, where I think we have a lot of people, at least in the U.S., that are so I just think they don't realize how, you know, how much the sport draws and how people are invested into the athletes. And yeah, it's really, really fortunate I get to come over here and see this on every single year. You know, I feel fortunate to know the other side of the sport, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it almost is the two sides of the sport. That was going to be my next question. How did it compare to like Worlds? And obviously Hayward Field was a magical stadium. And I still think, you know, obviously that last night, yeah, at Europeans was probably better than any session that we saw at Worlds.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And way more people too. I mean, obviously I thought Worlds was awesome. I thought it was a great meet, produced, you know, unbelievable times and performances. And, yeah, it's pretty cool to have a home world champs, you know. We go to Hayward. I mean, I think I was in Hayward four times this year, for different meets and competitions. So it's really easy for me, and there'll never be a world championships that easy, you know, where you're just, we had an Airbnb across the street and we're walking the sessions and it was super, you know, super easy and nice. And, yeah, it's awesome. But at the same time, seeing Comm Games as well, you know, I got to Comm Games for a couple of days, and seeing the atmosphere there, I'm just like, it's crazy to me that we can't figure out a way to harness that in the U.S., that sort of energy and excitement for the sport. And I hope we can get there one day. I do believe we probably have to get out of Eugene, Oregon to make that happen. But at the same time, Eugene gets a big crowd and you know, they do love track there. And yeah, it was great. It was, Worlds was awesome. But yeah, going to Comm Games and seeing that environment and being able to come here and see this environment. I mean, I'm all for a world championship in Munich. That would be, if we have this, that sort of environment last night at a world champs, would be unbelievable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. It's interesting you say that. And Matt and I kind of wanted to ask you about this. Like, I don't think it's any secret that track and field in the US is a lot more lucrative than it is in Europe. So why do you think that is, considering here we've almost got a lot more fans that are turning out to meets and things, but yet the US seems to get or holds a lot of the money for the companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the companies are based over there, and you know, that's where a lot of their marketing dollars are being spent. And yeah, I think the investment into the markets in the US is obviously a little bit more than it is in some of the smaller countries all over the world. And yeah, I can't argue with that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think, you know, a large part of this is, you know, shoe companies trying to move product and trying to sell shoes and trying to be, what's the right word? Trying to be relevant and, you know, in running and, you know, have credibility with obviously having good athletes. And, yeah, I think a lot of that is targeted towards, you know, towards the US markets. And, yeah, again, a lot of shoe companies are based there and do most of their business there, or, you know, try to at least market their business there a little bit more than maybe they do in other places in the world. And so, yeah, I think there's obviously a component to the sport that, you know, that's where that's coming from. But at the same time, you know, I've seen it over the last couple of years that I feel like shoe companies are more investing more into athletes from all over the world and marketing them in the US or basing athletes in the US in different groups and things like that. And I think you're starting to see that happen a little bit more. And I think it's good. I mean, obviously in my team alone, two of our best athletes are British, and you know, we're trying to involve them in different things that the brand does and try to create credibility in the space. You know, it's a, My team, you know, sponsored by Under Armour, and their new up and coming running company, only got into running in 2014 and really launched shoes in 2015. So, you know, it's a space that they're not that familiar with. And again, to show credibility in their tech and their design and their product, you know, trying to bring in athletes that can compete on the world stage and, obviously be based in the US and train in the US with our group, but also race all over the world.
Yeah. Does it frustrate you at any point, whereby, you know, an American athlete, you can get them a better deal than you can a European athlete? Does that, obviously it would probably frustrate an athlete, but does it frustrate yourself?
I mean, there's certain incidences where, you know, I feel like I've been able to help European or an Asian athlete for different things. You know, different, again, it depends on where the shoe company is trying to put marketing dollars. And, again, just like you said, most of that money is being spent in the US. But there's definitely circumstances where, you know, there's been opportunities for a British athlete or a European athlete to sign with a brand. And again, you're going to see more and more of it as groups start popping up, you know, OAC Europe, OAC, you know, in the US, they're starting to get more involved in these groups. There's obviously New Balance has a group in the UK with New Balance Manchester. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw other groups starting to pop up in the future. And again, if more shoe companies start putting more dollars into, you know, these European groups or European bases, then I think you're going to start seeing deals on the same type of level, you know, as what you would see in the US. So, yeah, it might be lopsided a little bit right now, but I think there's always going to be those certain opportunities for athletes in other markets. And yeah, I certainly think it'll start evening itself out a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I think we hope so too. Like you said, especially with more pro groups in the UK, that'd be great, because New Balance Manchester seems to pop up probably about 8 years ago now. And I think we thought, as kind of UK track fans, that more would follow quite quickly, but haven't really managed to get off the ground. So hopefully, like you say, next few years.
I mean, I look at On Europe as a group that's going to bring in athletes from all over Europe. And yeah, I think you could see that as a possibility too, from other brands, you know, kind of following suit. You know, it's not just a one country, you know, where New Balance Manchester is pretty much focused on. I think they've had some athletes from other countries too, one or two here and there, but for the most part, it's been mainly Brits, where, you know, OAC Europe has, you know, I have George Mills there, you know, he has a German teammate, Luxembourg teammate, you know, people from all over. So yeah, Swiss teammate. I think you're going to see more and more of that. If I'd be surprised if not in the next couple of years.
Well, I think that's how the companies will compete as well, because, you know, America v. UK, you know, America's way bigger. But America v. Europe, you know, start leveling off a little bit.
Yeah. In terms of numbers, yeah. I mean, obviously right now the UK in the 1500 is ridiculous. The US can't hold any, you know, can't compete with that right now. But certainly in terms of like numbers, yeah.
Well, we'll ask you that now, actually, because I was going to save that question for later on. But being a coach as well, any idea why the US is struggling over 1500, given, you know, you have such depth, obviously the NCAA system that we don't have? Why is it that the US just aren't performing so much since kind of Centro era?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I feel like we've had a lot of athletes that are right there on the cusp and could break through. And for whatever reason, just, yeah, haven't had that. That expected breakthrough that I think that a lot of the coaches and a lot of the groups were expecting. I do think there's some young guys coming up right now that could be really, really good for the US. I mean, just coming out of college in the last couple of years or gone pro early, what do you got? Nagush, you got Cole Hawker, you got Cooper Tier, you know, some of these really young guys that, you know, I suspect are going to be pretty good and pretty high on the world, you know, on the world list. But yeah, I mean, we definitely had a little bit of a gap there, and certainly the UK is really, really deep in the 1500 right now. I mean, so it was Australia. I mean, there's a lot of depth across the world in the men's 15. It's one of the toughest events, and Trying to figure that out myself and trying to get some of our 1500 meter guys to be a little bit more competitive on the world stage. But I do think you're going to see in the U.S. the level rise over the next couple of years as some of these young guys with a lot of potential, I think, are going to be coming up and doing some damage. It's going to take a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think similar to how it has for us in this country as well, it's not like it's happened overnight. Like we had our era in the past and recently we've just been enjoying the wave again.
Yeah, it's going to come in waves, you know. It's in 2 or 3 years, we might have 5 or 6 guys at 332 or better, you know. It's certainly possible. I think there's certainly the talent out there. It's just, it comes in waves, you know, ups and downs.
For sure. Let's rewind a bit. And how did you first get into being an agent? Like, when did you decide you wanted to do that? And what point in your life were you at that point?
I ran professionally for a few years, ran for New Balance. My agent was Chris Lane, who's my boss now. I had an injury that I was going to be out for a really long time, and he asked me to come on and work for him part-time, and it was a good fit. And part-time turned into full-time really fast as the agency was really growing. He had worked for another agency and left and started Total Sports, and with another guy who ended up getting out of the sport for a really long time. And he needed some help, and it was real natural for me. I enjoyed it. I come from at the time I was coaching athletes already, and I kind of come from a background of, you know, how can I help athletes run fast? And I felt like I could do more for the sport and more for, you know, athletics in general. If I could help more people, than I could do from my running, you know. So it was a good transition for me. I was ready at the time, and it grew pretty fast. I mean, I signed my first athlete, I think, a year into working for Chris. I got registered as an agent myself, and I was fortunate to be in an environment, and he gave me a lot of freedom to grow and to be as involved as I want to be. And I do appreciate that, and it was a good setup for me. And like I said, it was just a natural fit for me. I started signing athletes and working with brands, and just kind of grew from there.
Is it hard to differentiate between coach, because it sounds like, you know, you started out coaching and then kind of slotted into that agent role? Even now, is that kind of hard to differentiate between the two?
Oh, I don't find it hard. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that certainly think that it's hard for me to do, but honestly, no, it wasn't. I was coaching at the time when I started working for Chris. I coached a small group in Indiana called Team Indiana Elite. It was a really developmental group that me and my college coach kind of got started at IU. We had a housing, and it was a good setup. New Balance provided us some equipment, and the biggest key was free housing. You know, we had free housing for athletes that was on campus, and we had track access and things like that. And we had a lot of success actually, and got guys, you know, real developmental, get guys coming out of school that didn't have deals or, you know, couldn't get deals. And a lot of the guys we had in the group ended up signing deals because they ran well and did well and, you know, earned sponsorship, you know. So that was a really good first introduction to coaching for me. And at the same time, I was sort of starting working for Chris. So the two things really paralleled is these guys needed help with that as well. You know, they needed, once they got to the level, they could get a contract. They needed help with that. They needed help getting in the meets. They needed help, you know, making their schedules and figuring out, you know, where the best races were. It was a really good introduction for me into how both of these things work and how to set up a group and how to make it a successful environment for athletes in the group setting. And then also, you know, how to work with athletes from a management side of things, because they were essentially my first athletes before I started signing people, outside of the people I coach. So for me, it's just been a natural fit the whole way. Started signing athletes and coaching different athletes. And at the end of the day, I think as long as you kind of keep the focus on just trying to do the best that you can for the athlete and whatever that situation is, whether it's, you know, obviously like to have opportunities for athletes within my group, but it's not the best fit for everybody, you know, and certain people want to look at, you know, our group and certain people don't, you know, and that's totally fine with me. There's no ego on my end. And I think that helps me, you know, keep it separate and keep the priority on what's best for the athlete.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting point you make, because I guess there could be a lot of tensions going on between like whether they want to be with the agency and not the group and things like that.
Yeah, certainly there's been situations, you know, where we're interested in an athlete for my group and I'm shopping them to another shoe company as well. And, you know, shopping them to Under Armour. And of course, you know, a lot of shoe companies, I think in the first couple of years that we dealt, you know, that I did the group or had the group, you know, felt like there was going to be this massive conflict of interest. But I feel like as long as you obviously show them that they have a fair shot and that they're, you know, again, trying to do the best for the athlete. And if that means, you know, taking them around and trying to get a better offer from another shoe company, I'm certainly going to do that, you know. And I think most of the shoe companies realize that now. And it hasn't really been an issue, I guess, in the last year or so, as I think, again, most brands know that I'm just going to try to do whatever I can for the athlete. And I think being upfront too with everybody, with other coaches, especially of like who I'm interested in from a recruiting standpoint for the group, or, you know, who Under Armour might make an offer to, or, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, making sure you're just upfront, being honest with everybody is sort of the key. Again, I feel like most shoe companies know at this point, or most coaches know that my priority is the athlete. It's not the group in terms of, you know, how we build it. Some people joke that my group is the ragtag group of people who couldn't get deals that, you know, we've sort of put together. And I like that, you know, it kind of gives me a little bit of a chip to say, you know, you didn't want this person, so I took them and now they're running really well. You know, so I just think again, keep in mind that the whatever the athlete wants is sort of my priority, and it seems to work out all right.
Mm. Yeah, can an athlete get by in our sport? It feels like a very secretive sport when it comes to deals. You know, getting into races, you kind of do need to be in the know. Can an athlete actually get by and reach the highest level without an agent?
Yeah, of course. I think so. I mean, again, they have to be at a really high level. You know, I think that's the issue. I think if somebody came out of school, came out of school as an Olympian or as somebody who could compete for medals, I think they can do it. I don't think it's the best idea for them to do, you know. I've certainly seen a couple people in the sport that have done it, and I don't recommend it. I don't think it's the smartest thing for somebody to take on. I think there's a lot of work outside of, training and competing and doing all that to manage all the other aspects that, that we take care of. But, I certainly think it is possible, and I've obviously seen athletes do it. But again, I think that the athlete would have to be at a really, really high level to even make it possible. You know, if an athlete coming out of school who's, you know, not guaranteed spots in a diamond league starts emailing meet directors and stuff like that, I don't think that's ever going to fly. You know, I don't think it's going to work out well for them. But I think it would. Certain situations, I think it could certainly work.
Mm. Yeah, one thing we wanted to ask you, we had Mark Rowland on the podcast before, and he kind of shared with us that he thought that NCAA athletes should consider going to coaches and groups first, and then kind of going for an agent after they've decided who they want to be with. You're kind of in a unique position, obviously doing a bit of both. Like, what are your thoughts on that opinion?
I don't know. I'd have to think about it a little bit more. I mean, typically it does work, you know, the opposite way. I think, you know, most athletes pick their agent first and then their agent shops them around to groups and coaches and brands. I think it's tough sometimes with coaches that, you know, if the coach is invested into the athlete, but the brand is not, then you got an issue, right? Like, I've certainly had that, you know, with Under Armour in my group, but there's certain athletes that I would like to go after and the brand just doesn't feel like it's a good fit, or feels like somebody else might be better from, a marketing standpoint, or you know, fill gaps in different training areas, you know. But that can be frustrating at times from a coaching standpoint, but I certainly understand it from, you know, from a brand standpoint, that, you know, if they're trying to build a group, you know, there's going to be certain priorities. And sometimes, you know, just what the coach wants is not necessarily the priority. So that can be where things get a little frustrating sometimes. I think Mark is probably speaking from that. I don't know. I certainly think it's the other way around. I think, I think athletes should sign with agents first. And then again, if the agent is doing their job and really looking after the athlete, then they're going to shop them to everybody. You know, they're going to have them talk to every coach and every shoe company and try to bring as many options to the table as possible. You know, so, it's tough. I mean, I certainly think if, and that, I also do understand from Mark's standpoint that, you know, one of the things that I think is really cool is when an athlete comes to you and says, I really want to join your group, or I really want to be coached by you, you know, that, I think that feels good, and that motivates you to, you know, also, you know, really try to, you know, get your brand or your team behind that athlete. So, I certainly see what he's talking about from that standpoint. So, yeah, I don't know. It's tough. I think if you're working with a credible agent and a good agent who's going to do their job, the best way to maximize your contract or maximize your options is to have somebody who's really going to, again, shop you around to everybody and do their best effort to try to get you the best deal possible, you know? Yeah. And that might not be like financial, you know, that might just be, you know, where you want to be, or, you know, training partners that you want to have, or, you know, I think some people could listen to this and say, oh, you know, you're just thinking about whatever's the biggest deal. And that's not necessarily the case. You know, I have athletes that come to me and say, hey, you know, I want to have training partners that have run, you know, sub 4 in the 1500, or I want to have training partners that have run, you know, sub 1320 in the 5K, you know? So sometimes an athlete's priorities are different things. And again, when I say the best for that athlete, it might not be financially, it might be, you know, other aspects of what they're looking for in the group, coaching, teammates, environment, things like that.
Yeah. I think an ideal scenario, you can just choose any group and any coach, but we know it doesn't work like that. You know, you probably do have to go down the agent route first. You touched upon, you know, it's cool when people approach you. Do you think that happens enough in our sport? Because I know a lot of athletes probably at that level where they are looking to make a move to a different coach, and they probably don't, you know, they're almost scared and they hold back from approaching coaches, approaching groups.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think there is athletes out there that, you know, hold back. And I certainly think that, I wish athletes would do it more. I'm with Mark Rowland on that. I wish athletes kind of could, you know, figure it out and know what they want, and, you know, see something that's been successful or working well, and, you know, want to contact that person or, you know, I think a lot of times people are so scared to make change and, you know, a change in environment, a change of situation could always help somebody, you know, and jumpstart things. I've seen it a million times. You know, some people just get stale in their situation or their environment or their workout routine or whatever it is, you know, and a change can sometimes be a really good thing for an athlete. And I definitely wish that athletes would be a little bit more proactive from that standpoint.
Mm. How do you think the kind of the role of an agent like yourself and others has changed since you started it, or has it?
I don't know if it's changed. I feel like we're losing opportunities, and that's one of the things that is frustrating. Sport. Like I feel like we're every year we lose a meet, or, you know, it's becoming harder and harder to get athletes in the competitions. We have fewer and fewer competitions, you know. That's one thing that I can tell from when I really got into working with Chris and in 2011 was, you know, we just had so many options in Europe. You know, we could have 20 athletes based in Leuven in the summer and not really worry about getting people into races, where now we have high level athletes that were, you know, struggle to get races just because there's so limited options. And, you know, obviously I think the sport is just elevated across the, you know, in every distance and every event, it's gotten better and better, and the depth in every event has gotten better and better. So, yeah, it's just harder, I think, at this point. You know, there's certainly a lot of opportunities popping up here and there, you know, in the States and things like that, that has been a bit of a lifesaver. And you can get, you know, probably 10 years ago when I first started, you couldn't really get 333 races or 332 races in the US, you know, besides outside of, you know, Prefontaine and New York Diamond League or something like that. And now, you know, with Sound Running and the work Jesse Williams is doing and some of the race opportunities that we've had over there with the USATF, you know, distance classic and the support that they're having, even from their sprint meets as well, in Florida and Texas and in California, you know, other opportunities popping up is really good. But yeah, from, I think across the board, I think I've seen more meets fall off than I've seen been added, you know, and so there's less opportunity, I think, which makes it a little tougher. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the things that I could probably touch on from a change standpoint, you know.
It's funny you say that. I feel like, especially in the UK, we've had a lot, I think across Europe as well, maybe the high end has kind of fallen off meat wise, but we got a lot of meets now. There's loads of races which are high level, but they're not suitable for an elite athlete chasing, you know, a qualifying standard.
Yeah. No, I was just looking at the start list for the BMC meet tomorrow. Is it tomorrow or today? Today, you know, and there's some good athletes there, you know. So, yeah, I think you got to take advantage of the opportunities to get out there and race sometimes, and hopefully that use that as a springboard to, you know, compete at a bigger meet or a bigger competition or, you know, somewhere to chase a time, you know.
Yeah.
Well, this is it. We've been crying out for that in this country for ages. Like, we've look at the ranking list, we've got plenty of athletes to fill our BMC meets, but they all choose to kind of go to Ortegum, wherever it is, and race there rather than all staying and doing the same meet and probably be in a similar race anyway. But
yeah, I mean, that was a big frustration years ago in the US. You had all these, you know, again, we'd have 20 athletes from Total Sports over in Leuven, and Flynn would have 20 athletes over in Leuven as well. And, you know, Mark Wetmore would have 5 or 6 athletes, 10 athletes over in Leuven. And we're like, we have 30 athletes, 40 athletes over in Europe. Why, we could do this in the US, you know? I certainly think there's, yeah, there's good races in the U.S. I think it's good for an athlete to experience coming over and learning how to race overseas as well. And you want to be able to get spots and guarantee races. You gotta elevate your game, you know. So I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that either.
Yeah, look, something I want to ask you is, how much does an agent influence an athlete's race schedule? And does that ever clash? You know, will you have the almost disputes with an athlete from your side? You're maybe advising them to do certain races to help, you know, with the finances and the marketing. Yeah. Does that clash with a coach or an athlete?
Yeah, I try to provide as much information to the athlete and the coach as possible, you know, who's going to the race, is, again, as much information as I can get from, you know, a race director or whatever. I give my advice and certainly, you know, will, again, share as much as I know, but at the end of the day, my standpoint, from an agent standpoint to an athlete and a coach, is they decide the schedule. You know, I just try to make it happen. Certainly will, you know, tell them about races that I know are being set up or what paces are going to certainly, you know, what paces are going to be, you know, at certain meets and things like that. And again, just try to help and be helpful in the process of an athlete picking a race. But at the end of the day, yeah, my number one thing is the athlete and the coach choose what the schedule is. I never have told an athlete, hey, you should do this race or you should do this race. You know, again, if I'm asked or, you know, if a coach wants to know, like, hey, you know, Pete Julian came to me today. Hey, I really want a 1500 for Charlie Hunter, you know, somewhere around this time. Can you help us out? What's the best option? You know, things like that. But I'm never like, hey, Charlie, you should run this race or you're going to this race. I don't do that. You know, I don't even do that to the athletes that I coach. You know, it's always an open conversation. It's, hey, I think this could be a good opportunity to, I sat down with Katie Snowden yesterday and, you know, after Munich, you know, I'm looking ahead to what we do. I'd certainly like to get a 1500 in that we chase the standard for next year. So, you know, hey, maybe we race an 800 and you know, you have a time bonus for a mile. Maybe we look at a mile later in the year. You know, obviously she's coming up a bit late as she had COVID kind of at a critical time. So I think the best part of her season is still ahead. So yeah, it's just always an open conversation with me and the athlete of like, this is what I think. If you agree, then, you know, we'll go after this race or this opportunity. So yeah, my standpoint is it's the athlete and the coach drive the ship. And I'm just here to provide as much information and help as much as I can. Mm.
Talking about kind of your goals,
go on, man.
Oh, I was just going to say, it does suck when a coach says, hey, you know, I really wanted this opportunity for this athlete. We can't make it happen. That's a bummer too. You know, for whatever reason, you know, there's came to us too late. The field's already full or, you know, they're just not at the level to get into that race or whatever the case is, you know, always again, want to try to bring as many opportunities to people as possible, but yeah, it's tough. Like I said, there's a ton of depth in certain event areas and yeah, it can be tough. And that's an unfortunate part is, you know, we do our best. We're not, you know, we're not perfect either. We're not going to be able to get every single person, every single race they want.
Mm.
But I think we can find different options and make things happen too. So that's what we're here for.
Yeah, no. One thing I wanted to ask you about, obviously, was kind of let's talk about Ed Cheserek. Obviously, probably coming out of college is the biggest distance recruit ever, like most successful collegiate athlete on the distance side. How did that all happen? Because obviously you signed him, you coached him as well from the start. And I don't think I was alone in thinking that he was surely going to go to like NOP. Obviously Jenkins had gone there the year before and things like that. But like, how did that happen? Obviously signed with Skechers, which is a bit out there as well. Do you mind just sharing the story of Ed Cheserek?
Yeah. No, you're right. I think there was a lot of people who thought, you know, he would end up with Nike or OTC or NOP or, you know, one of their training groups as he was obviously very successful at Oregon. But again, you know, his priorities at the time coming out of school were, you know, guaranteed money and no reductions and, you know, whatever, again, trying to set himself up the best as possible for the future, you know, and, you know, support family and things like that as well as, you know, priority for him. So, the best, you know, our job there was to get him the best deal, you know, and, certainly Nike was interested and those groups were options, but, at the end of the day, Skechers had the best offer on the table and, you know, the most, longevity, stay in the sport for a long time with a lot of upside from, you know, bonus structure and things like that. And, it was a good fit and he didn't want to turn that down, you know? So, that's how he ended up with Skechers. And, again, I think there's a lot of, misconceptions in the sport that, you know, Nike didn't want him or he, you know, things like that. And it's just not the case, but, you know, he certainly had those options and you know, I think it turned out really well for him. I think he, you know, got a great deal and is in a great situation. You know, from a coaching side of things, Skechers didn't have a group obviously, or a coach or anything like that. Ed wanted to be at altitude, you know, so he came out to Flagstaff right away. I actually took him around to some different training groups as well. We went to Mammoth and visited the Mammoth Track Club at the time. They didn't have a affiliated sponsor. Now they're with ASICS, but at the time they didn't have an affiliated sponsor. So, we did a weekend trip to Mammoth and met with, Andrew Castor and, you know, looked at, different altitude training locations and places and coaches. And ultimately at the end of the day, he really did like Flagstaff And I was coaching a few people in Flagstaff at the time. This was really before the Under Armour group kind of got started, Dark Sky really started, but I was coaching a few independent athletes. Yeah, we just said, well, you know, do you want to stay here and train with me? And at the time it was a good fit because, yeah, I didn't have a big group or a lot of, you know, outside. It was just sort of me and him for like the first year, you know, and I think it worked really well like that. I think it's somebody that has to have a lot of, you know, individual attention. And yeah, it worked really well. I think he PB'd in every event, you know, he ran that year. You know, obviously ran 3:49 in the mile and got things rolling pretty good. And then went to Houston that summer, ran 13:04 as well. It was kind of a weird year in the sense of at the time and still to this day, he's trying to gain citizenship, and it's a long process, and there's been some bumps along the way. And, you know, I think he would still like to obtain citizenship at some point, but I don't coach him anymore. He's back with his college coach. Again, as my group got a little bit bigger you know, I actually do coach his fiance Sharon. She's in my group as well. And with Under Armour, but, he's back with his college coach right now. I think, you know, we got to the point where I felt like, his best running would be on the roads and in the marathon and, you know, half marathon. And I think he's got some incredible ability, in that event area. And I think he should move to that event area. I think he was a little bit reluctant and wanted to be with Andy as, you know, he felt like he had a lot of success in college on the track with Andy and still wanted to run a little bit more on the track. But, yeah, still work with him from a management side of things. We have him in a couple half marathons this year, which I'm really excited about, in the fall. So you'll see him most likely in Copenhagen and Valencia for some half marathons, which I think he's going to run lights out. Like he's so good at the longer stuff, and his economy on the road is incredible. And Skechers has some really good road shoes as well, which I think all those things combined, he can be really, really good in the marathon and on the road. I still think his best running is ahead of him. I know he's been quiet for a little while now, but like I said, I think if he makes the commitment to running on the roads, which I think he's in that space mentally now, I think he's going to be really, really good.
Yeah, I think so. You know, regarding the deal, I think there's very few times in our sport that you can have a deal which actually, you know, sorts you out for life almost, or a large part of it. In many cases, there's no such thing. So, can't blame him for that at all, really.
He's in a great situation, and it's a great brand. I mean, they've taken a really good care of him. Like I said, they put a lot of emphasis on working on this road shoe for him as well. And I think the sign, even back years ago when he was coming out of college, the sign was to hopefully look at him as a replacement marathoner from, you know, from Lesky days, you know? So, it's been a great brand for him to work with, and they've been really, really good to him. And, it was a great situation. And yeah, like I said, probably shocked a lot of people, as you know, I think most people thought when he came out of school, he was just going to be with Nike and be with one of their groups. And, yeah, again, it was a good deal for him. And, you know, I think a good example of us just, you know, trying to do the best that we could to get him the best deal for him and what he was looking for, you know.
Yeah.
If he would have come to me out of school and said, need the training group, I really want to be with, you know, 5-6 other guys that, you know, have run 13 minutes, you know, then maybe we look at Bowerman or OTC or something like that. But that wasn't necessarily his priority at the time. And we ended up with a good situation for him and what he was looking for.
How much has the citizenship issue impacted, you know, his career?
It's certainly been a burden, you know. It hasn't been an ideal situation. You know, I think his desire to compete for the U.S. and be a resident of the U.S. I think it's been important to him, and obviously hasn't worked out yet. I think I don't want to speak for him, but I think even if, you know, it happens after his running days are over, I still think he would like to have it. you know, it's not something I've actually spoke to him about in quite some time now, because again, it's been a process that's been going on for a long time, but yeah, it hasn't been easy. And I know it's been stressful on him. I feel bad for him and Sharon, and it's been, it's been tough on them for sure. It's kind of, limited what he's focused on, and, not having the ability to run for teams and things like that for the first couple of years was a bit of a, it just was a bummer, and it just wasn't a good situation for him to have goals and set goals and things like that. We had to kind of focus on other things. And, I think we were able to do that from at times, but I think at times it would have been nice to be able to say, hey, we're training for this team, or we're trying to make worlds, or we're trying to do this. And, so yeah, but like I said, I think his best running days are still ahead of him. I think he could be really, really good on the road. And I will not be surprised whatsoever if he's running, 59 minutes here in a couple months.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We hope to see that, because we're massive fans of Chez. And just before we move on from him, like, if anyone listening hasn't watched your flow track workout week with yourself and Chez, like, I'd recommend people do, because it's fascinating.
Oh yeah, it was long.
Seeing your relationship with him and things like that, and there's some nasty workouts in there as well. So
yeah, no. And again, we still have a great relationship, and I'm still working with him from a management side of things. I think, we're kind of looking at we're looking at different things, and I thought it would be an injustice to not, at least advise him on what I thought he should do at the time. And he wants to stay on the track, and that's time. He wanted to stay on the track, and that was his priority, and that's totally fine with me. Again, I think to hold two jobs like this, you can't have an ego, and I certainly think for him, the best situation for him was to be in a coaching situation that he really believed in. And my role there is just to be supportive, people say, oh, it must be tough, but it really wasn't. Like, if he thought that was the best setup for him and the best way for him to be successful, like, I'm supportive of it. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, before we finish up then, really, it's, where can money be made for upcoming pros, maybe current pros, beyond just contracts? Do you think there's a market anywhere?
That's a good question. I'm still trying to find it, if there is.
Yeah, what would you advise, like, I don't know, a 16, 17 year old kid right now? Do they need to be making a YouTube channel?
I mean, I certainly think there is an aspect of the sport that has gone that direction, and there's going to be ways to make money from that standpoint. One of the things that I would hope that the sport never gets too far away from is a focus on performance, and having performance drive earnings as well. I do hope we never get too far away from that as a sport. I think, again, it's always going to be a balance for an athlete of being able to train at the highest level, market themselves, attract other brands and other income sources, versus, just focusing on getting better and competing and earning money that way, and I've come across athletes that can do a really good job at both. And I've come across athletes that, the more they put in towards their social media and trying to drive, interest and, additional incomes through Instagram or social media posts or whatever it is that takes away from their running, And so, I think for certain people, it's, a YouTube channel or focusing on trying to gain followers and things like that can be managed and can be good, can be successful. And I think for other athletes, the best thing for them to do is put their head down and train and focus and do all the little things that they need to do better, to perform better and increase their earnings, that way. I know that's kind of I glossed over that. There could be a lot more, we could go a lot more detailed into that, but, Yeah, I certainly think that people ask me this question all the time. And yeah, there's people out there that make a lot of money on promoting different products, and they have big followings, and they're not that successful on the track or, you know, have legitimacy as an athlete, but they still have big followings, you know, and that doesn't upset me at all. You know, like that's people have places for, there's a place for that, obviously, but I think as a sport, I'd always like to see, you know, performance be rewarded, and people who, you know, get to the top and, you know, win races and championships and medals and break records and things like that. I certainly like to see them, you know, successful from a financial standpoint too.
Well, that's the thing, you know, have you seen performances become less relevant? Because it feels like they are, like you said, slowly becoming more and more relevant. And the thing with Instagram and YouTube is, you know, the general public aren't, you know, well educated on what competitions are good competitions and what competitions are weak competitions. So you could win, you know, a local road race and come across as, you know, a really good runner when obviously we know there's, you know, a lot of
people. Yeah, it's sort of what you want to get out of the sport, really, too. You know, so again, I don't have a problem with an athlete who, you know, promotes themselves or focuses more on social media. Like,
What about from a brand's perspective?
Yeah, I see. That's the thing that I don't think. I think most brands would still focus on performance. You know, because again, the person on the medal stand or the, you know, the person breaking the tape is providing legitimacy for that brand as a running company, at, you know, and so there's certainly companies out there that you know are signing people just for promotion or just for, you know, how many followers they have and things like that. But I think overall the mass majority of sponsorship in the sport is still being driven by performance, you know, and I hope we don't ever get too far away from that. But I do not mind more and more resources being brought into the sport from companies that do value, you know, likes and posts and, you know, engagement and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely agree with you there, like in terms of the performance thing. You said it doesn't upset you. I think it upsets us sometimes. So we'll happily say that. But no, like definitely agree. Like there's a place for Instagram and things like that. But most people listening to this would prefer it to go to the medal winners.
Yeah. Is something I want to ask you, like, is the Diamond League format, is that sustainable? You know, you talked about having 20 athletes in Europe waiting for these European races. Is the current format of our sport actually sustainable?
Oh, that's a tough question. I don't know that. I love the current, you know, ranking system. I'm just getting used to it myself. As I've only been in place for a couple of years now. I gotta say, I don't love it. I think I know why World Athletics has adopted it. I don't think from an agent standpoint, it's super popular. You know, speaking for a lot of my peers, I don't think a lot of agents like it. I don't think a lot of federations like it. I don't think a lot of shoe companies like it. You know, I think World Athletics likes it because it gets athletes to, right now it's highly promoting the athletes to run the races that World Athletics gets behind, you know? So I certainly understand, but I don't know that it's the best thing for our sport. Again, I think we're starting to lose competitions, and, you know, if a meet no longer, you know, if you have a great meet, let's say, I can't even think of a good example. I mean, let's say Houston, for example. It's my 5K PB's there. You know, we sent a ton of athletes there over the last 20 years, and it's a great meet, right? It's an awesome environment. Let's say for whatever reason, they don't have any sort of World Athletics ranking, right? And so, you know, people stop going to the meet and the meet falls off the map. And that was a great option for people to run at. So, yeah, I think it's, I don't necessarily know that it's the best option for us to have this system where we have to go to the races that World Athletics wants you to go to. You know, I don't know that that's how we grow, you know, and I don't know that that's the best system, but at the same time, I don't I don't have a fix, you know. I don't have a better solution right now. You know, I certainly think that there could be a lot more people in the room and a lot more people involved in the conversation that could put together some of my ideas that might be a better system and might have better results than the system we have right now, or could be even more sustainable than the system we have right now. You know, I think the money in the sport has gone down since I've been involved, since 2011, across the board, especially from, you know, a meet standpoint, meets, travel, prize money, you know, things like that. I do, you know, I haven't seen the big fall off from the shoe company standpoint, maybe the last couple of years with Nike, you know, just spending less money through the pandemic than what they had, you know, in previous years. But, but I think, from the meat standpoint, I think it's, I've seen it decrease every single year. So I certainly think we need some new ideas in there to change things up. And, I hope that maybe World Athletics involves, you know, agents, athletes, federations, more people into the conversation to maybe bring some better ideas.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. It seems like you said, there's so many people out there, some good ideas, but it's just not the people who have necessarily the power to change it all the time, which is unfortunate. But hopefully the more and more like people like yourself keep speaking, then we'll get some stuff in the next few years.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, look, anyway, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. Really appreciate it.